But Gilman announced that we had received this grant and...
$270,000.
Okay, okay.
For every 3 years.
So, I mean, everybody was ecstatic. That student body and that faculty, you know, were not yet accustomed to being radicalized by the events of the 60s. But still, everybody recognized that this would be a tremendous occurrence, that is, the coming of a more diverse student body. We didn't think then so much of faculty and staff. That was a later necessity that we had to encounter. But, you know, there was a, it wasn't a standing ovation, but it was just a hurrah, you know, and everybody said, that's wonderful. And we didn't know exactly what it meant, that is, what we were supposed to do, or how we could use that money, but essentially it was recruiting students, and that would take special people, really, and that's where Fred Easter, you know, and some others came in. It would take various kinds of counseling, you know, a person who would be a kind of mentor to black students. It would relate to housing, relate to social counseling, counseling in terms of kind of existing in this new kind of atmosphere for these students, but also academic counseling. These students, is my impression, and you know, check it out with Gropin and Morell and others, is my impression that these particular students came from high schools and family backgrounds where education was really valued. They were good students. They were not students who had academic or educational handicaps. They were also exceptionally bright socially. They were also aware of what was going on in the black community. They were real leaders. I could name, you know, picking a mugshot of them. These were really interesting people, very articulate, self-assured. At some points they began to get weary of white students asking, you know, well, what's it like to be a black in America? And, you know, they answered these questions for a bit. And then they said, you know, go out and go to the Urban Studies program, find out for yourself. They get just simply tired. There were social issues that came up as time went on, as they began to come in significant numbers. Well, it wasn't too much different from what was happening where I had been, you know, either at Andover, we had one. And that person's father was a classmate of my father's at Andover. So this kind of, you know, the token person. And there were a few more foreign students at places like Andover and Yale. Being Carleton was totally devoid of racial diversity. There were a few students from Africa, Tanzania, Kenya, mostly East Africa. There may have been some from other places too, but they were, you know, they were treated differently, as we know, you know. And they didn't necessarily associate themselves with American blacks. And that was a great disappointment to American blacks who went to Africa, let's say, expecting them to be brothers and sisters. They weren't seen to be brothers and sisters. But we did have, I would say we had, in terms of foreign students, we probably had 30 or so. And we made the decision, after we began to have large numbers of blacks, that we could no longer afford to have both. And that was a big disappointment, but it was agreed upon that that was the better choice than trying to keep the same number of foreign students with the cost involved. And then, because the Rockefeller didn't pick up the whole price tag by any means, it was just a stimulus. You know, I can't bring any experience of kind of familiarity with black persons or black life, but that was true of everybody. I mean, nobody in the student body, I would say, oh, nobody. There may have been a couple. Same with the faculty. So pre-Easters, were there black faculties at all? I don't think so.
Not that I've seen.
Staff? No. We didn't yet feel guilty that we were taking students away from those black schools. A little twinge of guilt, but I guess we thought, well, this is a great opportunity because they're going to rub noses with white people all their life, and these people, we think, are going to be leaders. And they aren't simply going to be leaders in the black community, they're going to be leaders in the American community. So we felt that we were doing something that was healthy. When it became apparent that not only these seven institutions were going in this direction, but across the country, at private and at public institutions, there were always more at public, but that they were also trying to get a large numbers of black students. It was mainly black at that time. It was called black after black power. Before that was Negro, and later African-American, Afro-American. But at the time, other schools were now, you know, getting in on this, and including black schools. They were recruiting different ways. But Stanford, you know, Chicago, Yale, Harvard, Michigan, whatever, were recruiting. So we were competing with them. And it became very strong competition, very competitive for us. We were a small school located in the middle of a soybean field in southern Minnesota. We were way out of it in many respects, even though the experience of the people who were there at the beginning, as they look back upon it, not at the time, but they look back upon it, this is a great opportunity for them. And the collegial relationships they had with other black students and with some whites and some faculty was wonderful. But when you're competing, you've got to go dip down further into the pool in terms of academic aptitude and performance. So, and Fred Easter would be a good one to talk with this, with him about this. Fred was here from 68 to, did he recruit Mark Hunter? I think he did. So Mark would have come here in 74. So let's say Fred was up to the latter part of the 70s, something like that. Although, wait a minute, I recruited Leroy Richardson, who was Fred's successor, when I was still dean. Now that sounds strange. I know I was still dean. Because I asked Leroy, who was a really interesting young black guy, really interesting, very bright. I said, after we talked for an hour or so, I was in the dean's office, why would you, with your interests, experience, etc., choose a small school like Carleton versus a school where there'd be many more black students, and maybe teachers too? And he said something that made me say, you're hired. He said, well, at a small school, you can know more people, a larger proportion of people, and you can affect that campus in ways in which you can't in a larger school. I said, I think you're right.
The changing attitude at Carleton towards social assistance.
Right, but I think things like music and drama and dance were areas where there was already a lot of tradition, a lot of experience and love of various kinds of music, and she was in dance, and so the Ebony group was basically an offshoot of that. The timing of these would be interesting, but it's my impression that there was a black choir that developed during that time. These were really interesting kind of social quasi-academic evolution of something from, you know, black culture over a long period of time that became a major kind of occurrence on campus, and white students enjoyed it too, but it gave some kind of opportunity for blacks to experience their own culture on a white campus and to have it appreciated. And there was a great deal of, you know, skill and beautiful voices and forms of acting, etc. That was, this was made available, opportunities were made available. And this, of course, is where having more black faculty and staff could be a major way to have this expressed. And you're the beneficiary and I'm the beneficiary of evolving time, where we have a Lawrence Burnett, and we have Mary Easter, we have the faculty in various departments, and where we have, where we spend money that's used in these ways and see it as being educationally and socially extremely important. So I think there was no objection to that. There wasn't much, but there was a lot more than it had been, and it has continued to evolve. Dormitories, we did have, I'm not sure we still right now have, but we had a black house, and that was a center of social activity, and for a while it was that big white house, corner of Second, between
it was
Second.
Hill, wasn't it?
Yeah, Hill House.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really the main single expression of black social life. You know, cooking was important, and haircuts were important. Now, there wasn't a barber in town that knew how to cut, you know, black hair. Some learned a bit, but others could go up to the Twin Cities. I would say that one thing that preceded the influx of Carleton black students was the ABC program, the A Better Chance ABC program, which started at Dartmouth, actually. I don't know, 7 to 10 a year that came in. So in a four-year high school period, you might have 30 or so black students in town. Ultimately, there were a few Latinos and some Native Americans, but it was mainly black. That changed the town, really.
Right, yeah.
It changed the town. There was some grumbling. There was some obvious racism, you know, calling nigger if the guy goes by in a car. But it was really minor. But it had to be attended to. It had to be a nipped in the bud. You can't allow that to have a life of its own. But it did change the town. And so when black students came to Carleton and beginning at St. Olaf too, the town became significantly more diverse than it was in 1960, let alone before. It was really joyful. So there was a good relationship between the Carleton black students and the high school black students. That was very important. In a sense, it was even more important than music, because it showed that this town was making an effort, and that they could, the older ones could help the younger ones. In some cases, the younger ones could help the older ones, because the younger ones had a town base, whereas the Carleton ones did not have a town base, it was a college base. And so to mingle with the Northfield parents of some black high school students gave them a kind of home away from home right here. I don't think there's been any resistance, but you always have to have money to support these, and primarily to hire faculty. And this is where Steve Lewis comes in. I think Steve Lewis and Beth McKenzie, his dean, had a kind of a deep working agreement that we wanted to diversify the faculty and staff. And we wanted to do it in a way that we didn't simply go out and get anybody. You know, the quality was exceptionally important, as it always should be for any faculty member. So they had a kind of agreement with chairs of departments. So-and-so is retiring at a certain point. You want to fill the position, right? Your chances financially of filling the position is for you to become more diverse. And in certain fields, that's exceptionally important. It's not necessarily important for the same reason in the sciences, but it is important in the sciences because you have black students and students from other backgrounds taking courses. And there's bound to be a benefit by having diverse faculty, even though in the terms of course material, it's not as important as it is in political science, all the social sciences, and most of the humanities. In music, it's not essential, but if you want to have music that appeals to a wide range of students and faculty, you're probably going to have to go into, you know, certain ethnic backgrounds. And Lawrence Burnett was a great choice, and St. Olaf did the same thing. Mary Easter was an earlier recognition of what she would bring that would not be brought by somebody else from a different background, although she's trained, you know, in all kinds of music, not just black, so-called black music. So I think there has been this gradual evolution, but then in the Lewis era, there has been this twisting of the arm. And in my closing convo in 1995, I complimented Steve Lewis and Beth McKenzie by saying how important I thought they had been to the diversification of the Carleton curriculum and social life because of their efforts to diversify the faculty and staff.
I guess that kind of leads me into the question of how, I mean, the faculty and the staff probably was not that diverse when this whole Rockefeller grant was began. Was there a push for diversity
from the Rockefeller?
From within the Carleton administration or anything like that? I mean, when you're getting this influx of minority students.
Right. Well, you were hearing definitely from black students, and to a degree white students, but mainly black students. Hey, you know, where are our peers or our role models? It's fine that, you know, a white faculty member or two might be a good role model for a black student, no question about that. But you certainly need black role models, both in staff and in faculty. First of all, it was faculty. I felt that seeing, you know, in a classroom, seeing a black scholar deal with material in a way that would be different from another good white faculty member, just bring a kind of richness. But inevitably, the role model meant the lifestyle and the way in which you relate to the faculty member, the black person, student, and faculty member. That would certainly be different. No disparagement of whites, but if you're bound and determined to have this diversity in the student body, the implications are that you want diversity throughout, in the staff, in the working staff as well. Though the market for that in Northfield or Faribault to work in, let's say, dormitories or in the shop is a bit more difficult, whereas the others you're importing from afar, but you can't import somebody from Biloxi, Mississippi to come and live here and bring the whole family here to work in the shop or something. So there are reasonable limits. But even there, they were trying to find people who were distinctly more diverse.